bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, welcome to the Photo Show. We're here to discuss the week's photographic news, such as it is, because it's not particularly great this week, we have to say. I've got the great panel with me, my compadres, the three amigos, Larry Mamakerley of photography. starting off with Mr. Forsman. How you doing, my mate?
Hello.
Good week?
It'll do.
Okay. Not bad at all. Sorry, you're glad you joined us this week. Is everything all right after last week? Hush.
Yeah, everything that I can talk about is okay.
Excellent. Good to hear. And also, from Essex, our man of fine arts and fine thinking, Mr. Alex Fox. How you doing, mate?
I'm all right. I'm looking around for that person of fine arts and fine thinking. I'm like, who is he?
Thank you for stepping in last night in the big show, mate, at the short notice. It's right. very much appreciated.
You must download it. I mean, I must download it, because I said something that I thought was quite innocuous, and then everyone started arguing. It was great.
It was a good show. I really enjoyed last night. I mean, I had this vision of us doing 10 topics, and we ended up doing 3 as normal. So.
But what was funny is, when they'd finished arguing, I went, that's not what I said. And they'd all been arguing about something I understood I said, but I'd never said that. So it was interesting, but I must listen back to it, because I didn't get any of it.
Oh, well. The Week of Photography. Big news story, I suggest, is that Getty Images has been purchased by the Carlyle Group, or is going to be purchased. The asset management group have decided to acquire them for a hefty $3.3 billion. Hellman & Friedman currently own a great stake of them, and it's a majority stakeholding that they're buying, not the entire thing. But co-founders Mark Getty and the Getty family will substantially give over their ownership interests in the transaction. Now, you said this was a bad thing, Chris, when you first saw the story.
Sam. This Carlyle Group, man, I do not trust them.
Well, do you have a basis for that? Them. I mean, let's be careful that we don't raise any slander comments here or anything. You have no freedom of speech on this network.
Oh, I forgot this is Britain.
Not where I'm going to get sued. Carlyle Group bought us, you don't.
This Carlyle Group is just known for some shady business, and so it doesn't sit well with me. Which, in my opinion, make that clear. That's my opinion.
Which bit of the previous warning didn't you get? Carlyle's shady dealings. You may have to name a couple of those.
I'd have to get on the internet and start looking crap up, and I'm just not interested in that right now.
Okay. Particularly when the lawsuit's mine, not yours.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Edit point there. Yeah, let's start the show again. Jesus. No, I mean, is there anything in this that's going to stop Getty being a greedy, cadaverous business that's full of tosspots?
More than it is now.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, what were you saying about a slander lawsuit?
Oh, I can take that. I can take that. That's fine. I mean, Getty is very good at manufacturing its own business interests from images. I mean, I've been around the sporting world a little bit, especially the golf world, and I've had no end of pros come up to me and say, excuse me, mate, do you work for Getty? No. And I said, oh, great, can I have one of those images that you've shot on me today? Yeah, sure, give me your email address, I'll send it to you. And I shot a picture of Brian, can't remember his name, Brian anyway, and he was, it was a great shot, perfect, and he said, I want that on the office wall, can you send it to me? And I said, yeah, he said, I've got loads of pictures of me on Getty, he said, but they want £3,000 for the small versions. I thought, you're kidding me. And he said, no. So, I mean, Getty, yeah, they're a vast image library, but they're not cheap, are they? You want stuff from them. They're not like iStock Photo here, or Pond 5, are they?
No, it's where the pros, well, I say the pros, that's where sort of high-end image acquiring goes. I mean, I've had loads of dealings with Getty, and some of them have been all right. But mainly, it's because of I've done work for other people, and then Getty have come along and bought them. So I've put my work with a certain company, or rather, I don't tend to put my work with a certain company. Certain companies pay me for work. So I don't take pictures and then try and sell them to people or put them in a library. Libraries approach me and say, we need images of this. Will you please go and do it for us? So, you know, that way you're guaranteed of being paid. But what has happened in the past, I've done work for some sort of Paris-based art companies, and then Getty's gone and bought them. But thankfully, my, I don't want to name names, the main company that I've been supported by for the last 20 years went and bought out that part of Getty for us. So as far as I'm concerned, any dealings that I've had with Getty have been bought out by other people. But what Getty has been very good at is they've just gone around the world and bought up historical libraries. Mm. So you may have an image that, you know, was taken 80, 90 years ago, very important image. And you'll find that unless it's an art image, because that's the part of the division they got rid of, you'll find that Getty now own it. So that's part of, that is part of the problem. And there's a 70-year image right, isn't it? It's gone up to 70 from 50.
Yeah.
So things that were coming out of copyright all of a sudden haven't. So there's an awful lot of, what do they call it, lobbying being done by companies, you know, larger companies to get the image rights and the copyright laws changed. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't go up to 100 years very soon. So I would, look, someone's always going to take it. I mean, the Carlyle Group are just, you know, a load of, what they call it, venture capitalists, and they see there's a profit to be made, probably breaking up Getty, I'd imagine. Because there's Getty has so many divisions in their art world and in their photo market, and I imagine that they would try and split off the slightly less profitable parts of Getty, because Getty have been doing that themselves for about the last 10 years. So I think this is probably what's going on. And remembering the families that own the Getty family that own it started it. I mean, Getty's not actually that old as in the photo market, but the family,
17 years, yeah,
it's not very old. I mean, I've been dealing with companies that, you know, are substantially older than that. But the family is still going to have a large part. That, you know, this 3.3 billion isn't for all of Getty. This is only for probably the bits that are worth money.
Well, it's a controlling interest, though.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But the family is still keeping hold of, I reckon the family will probably still have sort of 40% of it after this.
Mm.
But, you know, I don't know what they're going to do with it other than sell bits off, to be honest.
Yeah. Any thoughts, Chris? Other than just scared.
I feel like the way that you described Getty, maybe it is a good fit for Carlyle Group, I don't know.
No, I mean, Getty's not got... it's got a great reputation providing great images, which is one of its businesses. Yeah. But in terms of how it leverages and controls the market for image copyright, it doesn't have a great reputation for that, because it's over and above just simply, oi, that's mine, do you mind, take it down, please. Their pursuant activities are quite aggressive.
Oh, you don't steal a Getty image.
Almost Disney-like.
And again, maybe that's a great fit for Carlyle Group.
Yeah, I mean, I've got no issue. I mean, if they want to pursue legal entities to the largest degree, but I've heard stories, and they're only hearsay, so it would be unfair to say, but there's been stuff that goes on and on and on and goes beyond, you know, first child blood and semen as a method of repayment, pound of flesh. So, but that's pure hearsay. I have nothing to back that up, but there we go. Sony says that the compact market says that the compact camera market is on a steep decline, and I've got to say, I'm not sure if you sell tut like this. That looks like shite, doesn't it? hands up, right? Who wants a lime green credit card size CyberShot camera?
10 years ago, everyone did.
James Bond. There we go. See, okay, it's ugly as sin, says the in the chat room.
Yeah, but that's just one camera. I mean, let's be frank here. Sony's not the first one to come out and say this.
No, but also, I mean, I think they don't make
this
a lot
is just this cameras. Is just adding to the chorus.
No, I think Sony's actual problem is Here we go. Let's get sued by Apple now. Sony made compact cameras that were really ahead of the game in design. Sony's compact cameras from 10 years ago didn't look like cameras. They looked like credit cards with great big full screens on the back and a tiny little lens on the front. It looked futuristic and really cool. Everyone else had something that just looked like a shrunken down camera. And then Apple came out and they used the similar styling, shall we say, and turned it into a phone. So in that respect, Sony's fighting a losing battle because of... it's completely wrong to say their cameras look like the same look. It's not the word I'm looking for, but they look similar to...
Style.
There you go. They look stylish to a phone because it's not. Sony designed that style and the phones copied Sony. It's just their screen happens to be at the front and get covered in icons which are touched, you know, touch sensitive. But Sony came up with that form factor, if you like. And so they're losing by the very nature that people are looking at the Sony and saying, well, I don't want that. That just looks like a phone. Whereas it's actually, in truth, is the other way around. If you know, the compact camera market is dying purely because if you've got an 8 megapixel half decent camera in a phone which you own anyway, why own a camera that does the same thing? I mean, the moment you can get a proper zooming lens of any sort in a mobile phone camera, then that's the end of the compact camera market, full stop. But I feel sorry for Sony because, you know, one of the reasons they're getting hit hardest is because they look like phones, but they don't. Phones look like Sony.
Any thoughts, Chris?
I'm not sure I 100% agree with that analysis, but I think there's definitely kernels of truth in there, and I think it just boils down to the fact that, like you said, people just aren't using compact cameras anymore. They're just using their cell phones, and for you know, for taking pictures, pub pictures, is that what you call them, pub pictures?
Yeah.
You know, but that's all you need is a smartphone. That's all you need. That's all people ever wanted anyway. It was just something where they go, tap, there's a picture, hey, I'm gonna put it on, you know, upload it or whatever I'm gonna do with it, end of story. And or they're just gonna pass the phone around, everybody's gonna have a laugh at the guy puking in the corner or whatever. So I think at this point no one should be surprised that compact camera sales are tanking from any company.
No, I went out with one of the listeners yesterday, Gordon, and another listener, Steve, and we had a nice trip. That lovely day trip around the Severn Valley Railway. But it was surprising. Both of them were running around with iPhone 4s. And as soon as anything came up that was quick and instant, oh, I must capture that, the iPhone 4 came out, not the SLR. And it was quite interesting that this became the I must capture it instantaneous. And Steve's wife was there and she got a picture that she'd taken of the Queen driving by in their local village in a Rolls Royce. And it was a good picture. And it was captured with an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectly good. Would have hit the mantelpiece, no problem.
I've still got the argument that the iPhone is great in very good circumstances, but it's completely useless as a camera in any circumstance that isn't, you know, conducive to easy photography.
I'd agree.
So, you know, if you're actually
into... Generally speaking, day outs tend to be... You're out for the day, you're in decent sunlight, you're in reasonably well-lit areas, and you just want a capture of the moment. I mean, you're the man that's the proponent of capturing the moment.
Yeah, no, I agree, but that's sort of why you need something like Instagram to take, a moment capture picture and turn it into something that's slightly more interesting than just that moment. And, I reckon the vast majority of the pictures that I take that are for personal use... are done on my iPhone, but they're not really for personal use. They're for, oh, that's interesting, I want to show it to my wife later, then I show it to her, then I delete it. So in a funny way, it's doing something completely different to photography has ever done before.
No, it's the compacts have not don't do that, yeah.
No, that's what I'm saying. So, I mean, my iPhone is purely as just, oh, that's really interesting, I want to show the wife. Or I see a car that I know the kids would be interested in. You know, I don't even know what half of them are. They're just, if I don't recognize it, I know they must be really cool cars. So I take a picture for the kids. I show them the picture, then I delete it. So my iPhone is a camera, but it works in a completely different way. I would never take a print off an iPhone picture. And to be honest, I probably don't even keep them.
Mm.
So it's, for me, it's a very different thing. But it's got a use above any camera I've ever had before, because I would never have thought of taking a quick snap to show someone it and then throwing away the print. You know, so that's a different use.
The chat room have turned this into a campaign to bring back Symbian. I think, I don't know why.
Well, Nokia were the, what was it, the 5 megapixel on the N95 was the best camera for a hell of a long time.
It was, no, it was extremely good. Mm. And I've got to say, my son has managed to smash my iPhone to pieces this morning. It's not even functioning as a phone. And I've taken the glass off of the back and I'm waiting for a new one to arrive in the post tomorrow. But I've pulled the iPhone camera out and had a look at it, and I was holding it and showing Sharon. I said, see that? That's 8 megapixel camera with 1080p video camera in it as well. And she's like, wow.
You know what I suggest? You know when we were growing up and Chris was already, you know, Chris hadn't been born, we looked at James Bond type pictures or James Bond films and had these tiny little hidden cameras, and they were like quite small. Now in reality, we have cameras, all of us own cameras that are 20 times smaller than the smallest thing we've got in James Bond. I wonder what the CIA and the MI5 have now. I mean, their cameras must be so small they're invisible.
Well, they're mounted on flies and they land on and hover. And
with 1080p video.
No, they're shooting 4K. Don't be stupid. Yeah.
That's my point, though. If we've got that technology, can you imagine what the technology we don't know about that's already out there is? Oh, let's all get paranoid.
Let's imagine the technology we don't know about.
Well, that's my point, though, isn't it? We're living the James Bond of 25 years ago, so I wonder what the James Bond today must be like.
True. Absolutely. The European Awards for Photography are out there, 2012 to 2013. And there's a whole pile of winners, not least of which, this will make Alex happy, the Nikon D800 is Camera of the Year.
Well, they're only human.
36 million pixels and Alex's heart.
Aww.
Have you bought one yet or not?
No, I'm actually still doing resisting. My sensible... No, I'm not resisting. I'm doing a sensible thing and putting money in a bank account, so when I do buy it, I don't owe any money for it.
I've got to say, I am seriously... I've had a good year this year, which last year was kind of uppy-downy. This year has been seriously good, and I'm seriously thinking of jumping ship and getting a D800 and bit the hell with it. Just chuck
well,
it
you know what?
All the lenses, everything's going
to go. Go to Calumet, buy one for the weekend, and if you like it, they knock off the higher price from the purchase price.
Yeah, but the problem is if I go to Calumet and I hire it, then I'm definitely going to get rid of everything. There won't be any sanity left in the decision, will it? At the moment, I've got a detachment. I've got a... I haven't tried it yet.
Yeah, that's why not like trying it's a good dealer. Thing. I'll be like your drug dealer. When I get hold of it, I'll say, Ewan, have a go with this.
Good. I know Alex you want to. Tambourine, man. Bring in a D800 for me.
Yeah, exactly. It's a wonderful boring. Camera, and I'm looking forward to the D5. Because, you know what, the D4's good. I mean, it's very good. But can you imagine, right, they've done this 36 megapixels. There's no way they're going to get away with a D5 that's under 36 megapixels. So we'll say the D5 in a year, 18 months' time, is going to be a 40-plus megapixel. Unbelievable. I mean, it might cost $6,000-$7,000, but it's going to make medium format now look old hat. A medium format's going to have to up its game. So I'm really quite looking forward. I think this is such a big game changer that everyone else has got to absolutely up their game, including Nikon. Because Nikon can't have this because of, I know enough professionals that are going, you know what, I'm not going to spend $6,500 on a new D4. I'm going to buy a D800.
Yeah.
Because I don't, the D4 is slightly better in certain respects, but for most photographers I know, the D800 does everything they want. And Nikon are actually slightly slitting their own throat, so they need a D5.
Yeah.
And Canon have got to come up with something super duper. And, you know, so maybe hold on to buying a D800 because Canon's got to up their game as well. And you know who's going to be best, I think?
The D4 and the D1X or whatever, those just came out.
Yeah, but
you already want a new model?
Well, no, the point is because of the D800. is so successful at 36 megapixels, they're not going to sell as many of the D4s as they would have done before. They're just not going to. Yeah. And you're going to get people, you know, the newspaper
people. The D4 is priced for low sale. It's a niche camera.
Yeah, but I think people that would have bought that aren't now. I think the people I know that would have gone out and bought a D4 on day of release aren't buying it. They're buying the D800.
Mm-hmm.
And Nikon are losing money. Sony are the sensor people. I think Sony are going to come out with a 60 million pixel sensor.
My camera was 6.5K when I bought it, and it's probably worth less than a grand now. And I'm at the stage where I'm thinking I could get another camera. It takes perfectly good pictures. Nothing a good service wouldn't solve. But I'm sitting looking at the DX and thinking, I don't really want to spend $6,000. I'm just sitting thinking, should I get a D5 instead? And to be honest, for most of what I do, I'd probably do just extremely well with the 60D. It would be fine. And I've got the video option as well as, and why would I want to go? It's pure, in my own mind, there's a certain element where I want a bigger camera and I like having the pro level camera, but logically speaking, for what I shoot, I could probably get away with that quite happily.
Sure. I think the D800, the thing about the D800, it's a great camera, but the video is extraordinary. I mean, the video on the D800, I've seen people that obviously know how to do video. I haven't got a clue. I've only ever done point and shoot video, and I think, well, that looks nice, right? Mm. But I've seen people, and I can't spot the difference between that and sort of a £20,000, you know, what I'd call a proper video camera.
No. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not saying there isn't a difference, but me as a layman, I can't spot the difference.
Well, I bought a D600 to play with, and I've shot commercial videos with that people have been incredibly happy with and said, isn't the quality good? And I spoke to Dave Dugdale because he was doing his comparison of 600D versus 600D. And I said to him, did you notice a difference between the video quality in either? And he said, no, not a bit. He said, it looked exactly the same to me. I couldn't see a difference at all.
Yeah. Very what good. Might be interesting, though?
None of which is to do with the ESA Awards, by the way.
No, that's fine. There's not an awful lot else to talk about. What would be interesting, though, is, you know, there's a new move into some of these cameras where you get built-in filters built into the camera and various things. All of the Instagram-style things I can't stand. But once the cameras get a little bit more powerful, I'm just quite looking forward to being able to see what the video filtering is going to be on board, because that could be really special and very, very useful.
Stabilization, I think, is a big thing as well. I mean, there's a good point from Bookery in the chat room here saying about... you need a stabilizing rig to shoot good video. I'm not going to agree with that totally. I shoot off tripod as much as possible, I have to say. But if you're handheld and you've got an f1.8 lens in there, shooting with the 50mm f1.8 for Canon, because of the fact you've got that massive depth of field effect on there, you can get away with a lot of camera movement, and people just go, oh, that's kind of here and now. That's really, you know, contemporary. That's cool. Yeah. as long as the person's in focus, you can get away with an absolute shed load.
Yeah, but with the sensor sizes, I mean, I know I got laughed at that last time, but you know the way, you know, image stabilization in photography works in a similar way to video. If you've got what it is, it's not so much the sensor size, it's the actual processing power within the cameras now. Now, if the processing power can get a bit higher, you can do image stabilization with, you know, moving around the crop. You know, the same way as I think Final Cut Pro does it. You know, so you'll be able to do onboard image stabilization via the processor. So you should be able to do panning and various things. You know, or you might be able to press an auto panning function. So as you pan, it stabilizes your pan as you go around electronically.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's the next. It could be extraordinary. I don't think still photography, is going to be the biggest improvement now. I think it's the videography that's going to be the biggest improvement.
Well, I mean, you've got sensors that are capturing multiple more pixels than the video is going to shoot at 1080p. So you've got that strip around the outside to stabilize within.
Sure. But, I mean, if you can capture the extra 20% around the box and then stick it into Final Cut Pro, the way Final Cut Pro works now, it's actually a crop. If you don't actually have to crop, if the bit you get is only in the middle bit, and then it can move around that 20% border to keep the stabilization, you've got no actual crop as such. You've still got your 1080p, but it's taking that 1080p from a slightly different part of the box all the time. It really will be extraordinary. You won't need great big rigs anymore.
The Canon 5D Mark III was a SLR and European Advanced SLR Camera of the Year. The PowerShot G1X was the European Compact Camera of the Year. The Fujifilm X-Pro1 was crowned the European Professional Compact System Camera, and the Olympus TUF TG1 won the award for European All-Weather Camera. There we go. Tamron won a thing with their lens as well. 24-70 f/2.8. Also claimed European Lens Award.
That's quite impressive, isn't it?
That's for Tamron, then. That's good. I mean, yeah. We talked about Tamron last week, and I had a serious look on Wex for Tamron lenses. And I had a friend out in America this week, and I said, you know, just go into B&H and have a look at what the prices are like, see if they're any different from online. I was getting it probably £20 more expensive here in the UK, and for the issue of warranties and returns and that kind of stuff, and consumer protection. And the fact that he's a Nikon user, just say, I'm not going to know that it's working until it's back here. I might as well just buy it from Wex. You know, so good on him. Mm. There's a new Canon on the block. Well, I did have a picture of it. Where's the picture of it gone? I haven't got a picture of it. Never mind. What an arse. Where's the picture of the Canon gone? Here we go. Here's the picture of the Canon. Oh, it's not working. That's interesting. That's why it's not on there. There you go. That's the picture of the Canon. it's the Canon IXUS 510HS. There we go. Any thoughts, fellas? We've got a review that's come through from Amateur Photographer. So there's the picture of it. The IXUS range has got a good history, hasn't it? I mean, I've got an IXUS 3 that the kids use, and I've got an IXUS 7, which the kids are going to use when I find out where the battery charger is for it. They're good little cameras. They've always been good little cameras. Are these the Elf with you, Chris? Hello, Chris? Chris? You're on mute, dude. Are you on mute, dude?
Hello?
Hello, there we go, he's back. Were you explaining something there completely different for a while?
I was talking about who shot JFK, and it was the whole thing. No, I was going to say that what's really interesting about the design of this is that it's really squared, and all the sides and everything are really flat, which reminds me of like some of the original digital Elfs.
Yeah. Well, the 3 was exactly like that, just silver.
Mm-hmm. I had an early Elf, and then I ended up getting it replaced like an S, and here in the States it was called SD300. I'm trying to even remember. I mean, it was maybe 4 megapixel or 8 megapixel. I can't remember, but I remember that the first thing I did when I bought it was set it to 2 megapixel, and every picture I took with that camera was at 2 megapixels.
It was good. It's good, good, good. I think the IXUS 3 that I've got that the kids run around with, that's got a compact flash in at 128K. Or 128 meg, rather. Booker in the chat room says, was it the Canon shooter in the library who shot JFK? any thoughts on this camera, fellas? Because I've got to say, when you do the 100% crop shots on it, you can see some issues, particularly when it gets to ISO 3200, it really gets very crappy very quickly. But if you pull back and look at the general images, I mean, this isn't going to translate to video particularly brilliantly, but that's the ISO 100 image, F4, and it's 1/50th of a second, I think.
I've got one of those cameras.
And then there's a slight change, and that's the one at 3200. And actually, if you were talking about sticking that in a 7x5, you know, the difference between the two, yeah, there's a lot of detail. If you look at the focusing ring and that kind of stuff, you can definitely see changes. But that would cope. Bit of correction for the yellow, but that would cope. Bit of sharpening maybe would help.
What people don't tend to take into consideration is, a basic print is at 300 dots per inch, right? And if a 300 dot, you're looking at 100% on the screen, okay? A 300 dot per inch, you can't see 300 dots, okay? Now, that's why we print it at 300 dots per inch. So if it's a slightly bit out of focus or a slight bit of aberration, the human eye will not pick it up. So even if you print something at 300 dpi at 100% of the sensor size, your eyes will not see it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's fact. So when we blow these things up and go, oh, 100%, it's a tiny bit iffy. Well, so what? I mean, you don't need to reduce it to 7.5. You can print it at its maximum 300 DPI resolution, and you and I and nobody else will see the difference.
I think the thing that you'll see with that one, though, there, and this does happen quite a lot with high ISO stuff, is that you'll start to get aberrations in terms of the colour. So, mm-hmm. you know, where you've got the nice crystal clear there of the 100 image, you go up to 3200, you're getting distinct yellowing starting to appear, the camera's starting to guess on colours a little bit more.
Okay, all right.
And once you've corrected, I agree. I think you're absolutely right, Alex. There's no, and as I said there, you could take that and show it on a 7x5 or even a 10x8, and providing you've corrected the colour for the aberration, I think you can have a very, very functional image.
I was just wondering, do you reckon the Canon Elf is known as the Canon Leprechaun in Ireland? I don't know why these things happen to me.
Anyway, the good news is it's £275 for this thing, which I thought was, yeah. I mean, we were talking last week about phenomenal prices. I think that's a great price for that. Not bad at all. Chris, any thoughts on it?
You've got a 12x optical zoom. I mean, I remember when the hot new feature on compact cameras was a 3x optical zoom.
Yeah.
Because for year, you know, I mean, for we're talking like the first 3 or 4 years of digital cameras, a 2x zoom was like, you get a zoom or you don't.
Dude, I remember when motor wind-ons for SLRs were the dog's bollocks. So, I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah.
Well, I've still got a camera where you actually slide it from telephoto to non-telephoto.
Oh, God.
Uh-huh.
I found it in one of the toy boxes with the Sony disc cam. And you just slide it open. I can't remember what it is. It might only be 2 times. But, I mean, you even look through the viewfinder and it goes from pretty bad focus to nearly completely out of focus. But that's the best you could get those days. Mm-hmm. It's quite cool. Not rubbish, but quite cool.
Yeah.
I'm just making a note of the show title, Canon Leprechaun.
So, I mean, like I said, I used, I can't remember what I had, one of the first digital L's, I can't remember what it was. I had that for a couple of years, it got damaged, and then I got an SD300, which I used, which I had up until like maybe a year or two ago. And, you know, I used it all the time, and I ended up just getting rid of it because all I ever used was my iPhone. And all the time I think about, oh, you know, maybe I can get like an S100 or an S90 I looked at, and I keep thinking about getting another compact, but the fact is I just use my iPhone all the time. I'm probably just never going to buy one. It's unfortunate because I imagined I would really enjoy using this camera, but I just can't bring myself to do it.
Well, I say this, I would quite happily go out with the Ixus 7 that I've got, and mm-hmm. in decent lighting conditions, I could probably shoot an image and I'd get away with selling it to a customer. They're good mm-hmm. cameras. They've always been good cameras. I don't believe that this one's going to be any worse. And I thought as well, some of the macro shots, it did really mm-hmm. well on the macro shots. It's extremely good macro. So if you're thinking, looking for a Canon, you know, tiny compact camera, £275, it's yours. Wex is the cheapest one at that price as well.
I mean, the lens is basically the equivalent of like one of these Tamron, you know, 28 to 300 lenses they have.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that, what do they have? Like
without the soft focus at the top.
Well, I'm sure it has some softness at some of the focal range. I mean, you can't make a tiny little 12x zoom and not have some, not be perfectly sharp at every focal length, no. But. I'm just remembering when this was such a revelation for SLRs. You'll have this 28 to 300 lens you could buy, and how heavy and big it was, and you know you'd slap that on an SLR, and it was like the best you could get. And now you can basically take all that, fold it up in your pocket, that shoots at 3200 ISO and image stabilization and all this other business, and you just slap it in your pocket and take it with you. I mean, it's amazing. And then, like you said, at the price for $270, it's just, it's mind-blowing now. And I just, like I said, I feel like it's unfortunate that I can't bring myself to just buy a new compact camera because I'm just using my iPhone all the time.
The chat room, we're talking about the cutting edge of photography. The chat room is comparing 110 cartridge film cameras that they used to own. I had an Agfa 110 that did that, says Pete. Really good. Mm-hmm. There you go. Enjoy your 110s, everyone. If you've been thinking about wondering what the difference is between a CCD sensor and a CMOS sensor, then fear not, because PC World in Ireland has done exactly the hard work for you and shown you the difference via an image.
This made me laugh earlier too.
This picture was
it's
on
like those before and after pictures of people who get like makeovers, and they're like the before picture's like all.
Yeah, A, don't smile as much in the first image as there is in the second. Do you think they've got a whole pile of CMOS sensors that they can't shift at the moment in this store? I mean, that was. If you've seen that picture and you don't read the accompanying article with it, by the way, that is a completely different lighting setup that's caused the difference there. It's got absolutely sod all to do with the sensor.
Right.
I'd be right in saying you won't spot the difference in a sensor from looking at an image. Because I don't think I could.
No, I mean, well, there is no difference. It's just it's the different way it's captured. It's
still red, green, and blue.
Aye. Yeah, one's analog and one's digital. That's the only difference.
And the quick draw is out there. This is a lighting setup, or this is a setup for your lenses that goes on your waistband. So you've got a utility belt like Batman, and you can unclip your camera's lenses and quickly change them. So if you need to be that quick, you can be that quick. There you go. Anyone thought about buying this?
I thought it was one of the most ridiculous things I've seen in a long time.
Thank you. That saved me saying it.
I'm not into being rude, but I like watched that and I thought, are you kidding? Has anyone got to change a camera lens that quickly? Is there something wrong with him?
You never see pros carrying belts around with camera bags on them. You only see amateurs because only amateurs feel that they needed to be Batman. So.
You'd also get a bad back.
Anyone out there who's thinking of buying a utility belt to hold like camera lenses off or you know, photo patches and stuff like that, don't, because you look a twat. Okay. Should we do some questions? Unless you want to join in the dog pile here, Chris.
No.
Yeah, that's no. We kind of covered it.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Questions. Question one. This comes from Ian Lewis in Cornwall. Thank you for writing in, Ian. This has probably been discussed before, but as a newbie to the show, wondered if your thoughts were on Apple Aperture versus Adobe Lightroom. I've been using Aperture since version 1 and currently use the most recent version, but I'm now getting frustrated with its performance, even on my 2011 MacBook Pro. It feels like Aperture has been forgotten by Apple and it sees no major updates for a while, and Lightroom is taking the lead. Should I give Lightroom a try or just try Apple and get... I just trust Apple that they'll get back into the game. Lightroom's a 30-day trial anyway, isn't it?
Mm, yeah.
It's Photoshop, so you can give it a trial, Ian, as far as I'm aware. Any pros or cons over and above the two? I mean, I'm not a Lightroom user, so I can't do a comparison. And I don't really use Aperture. I was talking yesterday. I tend to just store images in folders because I know where the folders are. They're stored by customer, by type, and that kind of thing. So, I mean, Chris, as the photography writer a little bit more, have you got any pros or cons, one over the other, that Ian should think about?
It's tricky because they have similar feature sets. I mean, they're both programs are trying to do the same thing, but I think he's right. I mean, Apple hasn't updated Aperture in a long time.
No.
What my sources have told me is that there is an update being worked on to Aperture. I can't say anything about whether it's going to be awesome or worth waiting for or not. And I think what is important here is that he's identified an issue. The performance isn't cutting it for him anymore.
Yeah.
And when that's the case, it's absolutely worth your time to check out a different program. And it sounds like he has pretty recent hardware. So, you know... There's
no reason that Aperture 3 should be slow, though.
I'm going to guess that it has to do with his library getting really large, and this is an issue with, you know, it's an issue with iPhoto, it's an issue with Lightroom, it's an issue with any of these type of programs that keep track of a library. When you do it all into a single library like that, and once it gets to a certain size, that you're just going to run into performance issues because, you know, it's like a giant database, and it's really fast when the program can keep the whole database, the whole index in RAM. When it can't keep the whole thing in RAM anymore, it's swapping out to the hard drive.
Yeah, I mean, Ian's in the chat room, as it happens, and he said, question was from me, thanks for answering. Running on 4GB of RAM, any significant gain from going to 8? I'd say definitely, and his library's 24,000 images, so that's a sizable library. So anything's going to struggle with that. Although Russ does say that he believes that Lightroom is quicker than Aperture. Alex, any thoughts?
Well, I only ever use Aperture.
Bandwidth and hosting for the British Jet Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.
I used to use Lightroom years ago, and I don't think I even bothered reinstalling it on my Mac when I did the last reinstall, because I just didn't see a point to it. So that was might have been Lightroom 1, or it might be Lightroom 2, I can't remember now. But I just, if because I use Photoshop, I just use Bridge. And Bridge, if you play around with it enough, you can use it as Aperture and as Lightroom for no extra cost. And you get Bridge with what's called Elements.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're looking for a third-party piece, go and buy Elements and get Bridge for nothing, because of you can use Bridge in exactly the same way, plus you get a lot better... you can adjust your pictures a lot better than you can in Aperture. So, you know, that's my suggestion, which is the third option, but, you know.
Very good. No, that's fine. I have nothing to add because I don't use either particularly, so I just store my files in folders and that's it. Question two. Hey, guys, love the show. I'm a keen film user, and last week I got a pile of old Kodachrome from a car boot sale. I paid £5 for 30 rolls of varying ISOs, and I'm aware that some of it may be use, but I got straight home and put it in the fridge, and then it hit me. Why do you put film in the fridge? Surely room temperature and away from direct sunlight would be good enough. Interested to know what you think. Is it necessary or just more photography bull? Also, how long can you keep it in the fridge before you need to use it? I've no idea how old it is, as all the dates on the boxes are expired by at least 2 years. Cheers, Patrick of Enniskillen, Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Alex, start us off, mate.
Well, yeah, first of all, yes, it's important to put it in the fridge. And if you can, put it in the freezer. If that film you've got now, which is 2 years out of date, had been kept in the freezer, there would be nothing wrong with it at all, even though it's 2 years out of date. Again, just on top of that, if when you use it, you'd have to go to a proper processor. But then again, I don't think you can get an amateur processor anymore for film anyway. If you tell them that the film is 2 years out of date, they can process it slightly differently to try and recover the fact that it's likely to have faded a bit. Mm-hmm. And to let you know why things change, film, obviously, it's a chemical reaction to the light. Mm-hmm. But what a lot of people don't realise, and I only really sort of know the basis of this through astronomy, actually, but heat is actually a form of light. Heat is, you've got your visible ranges of light, then you've got infrared, microwave, radio, ultraviolet. I'm reading it because I looked it up earlier. X-ray and gamma ray. And all of those are actually radioactive heat levels. And the film is actually sensitive to light, but not only in the visible range.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can keep the heat down, therefore, these other ranges of light that we can't see don't affect it. So that's why you keep it frozen or cold. And that's why it slows down the process of it. Because you actually, if you go through, say, an X-ray machine enough times, the X-rays will actually slightly fog your film. It's an issue we had years ago with large format film.
And the same thing with heat. Same thing with heat. Exactly. If you get it hot enough, it'll eventually just fog the film.
Yeah. But a heat actually, and you know, factually, heat is actually a form of light. So that's how these halogen cookers work. The heat is generated by that wavelength of light. And, it's a bit of a scientific explanation, and I don't know 100% of it, but that's why you keep it in the fridge.
Because heat and light being the operative word.
Pardon?
Bit being the operative word.
Yeah. I thought that was quite good.
That was excellent, mate. Well done. Thank you, Wikipedia.
No, I only looked up the different variations.
I'm joking. Calm down.
If I was reading it,
calm down. Anything to add, Mr. Forsman?
No, I mean that's
it.
Pretty much hit the nail on the head. I mean, film is sensitive to more than just the visible wavelengths of light, and as Alex explained, infrared light. We don't see it with our eyes. We feel it as heat. So, you know, the film sees it as radiation that it can react to. The chemistry in the film sees it as radiation it can react
to. I've got to say, though, I always thought that if you kept it in the little black tub and it was in an ambient temperature, you know, not direct sunlight, mm-hmm. under the stairs, somewhere like that, where it's relatively cool, that would be more than enough. I didn't think you needed it in the fridge. I thought that was a bit of
no. If you kept it in a lead-lined box underneath your stairs, you'd probably be all right.
No. I've had lots of years of therapy trying to get the dark room out of my brain. I'm not going back. I was shit in the dark room. There we go. Bleep needed. Beep. Three, dear you and Alex and Chris, I've been shooting with a monopod and regularly get down to 1/15th of a second and got images without a blur. The other day, though, I got caught out without it and I hit 1/30th and couldn't get a clear image. How low have you guys ever gone? And is there a tip or a trick for getting shots at low speed? Cheers, Chris Francis of Camberley.
I don't know about how low I've ever gone. I mean, is that really a photo-related question?
Probably.
Is this time to brag it? Come on, how long is yours?
I was going to say 1/8 of a second, I think, is the lowest I ever got. And that was with, I think, a 50mm lens.
Right.
You know, the focal length is going to make a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
I've got a 600mm f4 and I shot at 1/8. It's pretty impressive. You would have me then, mate. I'd marry you on that.
No. But I've shot 1/8 with a 50mm lens before. I've shot a lot of band photography, so in all clubs of all sizes and shapes and lighting situations. So it's always a real test of your patience to get decent shots in some lighting conditions. So you know, it's just like you steady yourself, you hold your breath,
lean against something.
Lean against something. You squeeze the shutter very calmly and instead of mashing on the shutter button. I mean, there's all these little kind of tricks and you just have to use them all, and even still it's like, you know, just hope it comes out, please. It's just kind of always a trick, and everybody kind of has their limit. I have a friend who's like has kind of shaky hands, and he used to shoot at a lot of weddings and just wasn't happy with his images until I was like, here, buy this image stabilized lens. And then suddenly all his wedding images were super sharp. So yeah.
Cool.
Everybody's a little different.
Alex, how low can you go?
It's the limbo.
Shutter speed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've gone down to the very depths of depravity, if that's what you're talking about. One of the tricks, I don't know how low I've gone, other than that last comment. One of the tricks I would use, and I have used, is to use the self-timer. Because even when you're, you know, hand-holding with the self-timer, because you're not moving your fingers and you're doing nothing, and in a funny way, because you're not actually completely and utterly concentrating on that, you know, the millionth of a second when you want to press a button. If you use a self-timer, that tends to help me in any way hand-hold a picture. But, you know, in general, I'm not very good at it. How low have I gone? Not very low.
Admission is the first step forwards, mate. Well done. I'm Alex Fox, and I've got wobbly hands.
Yeah, that delirium tremens don't help.
I've done a picture of the moon at 1/15th freehand, and that was with a few 2x extenders on a 2.8 70 200mm lens, and it was good. It was okay. But brace yourself off, like Chris says. And the other thing is shooting three bursts. So put it in burst mode and shoot three shots. First one will be crap. Second one will probably be pretty crap. And the third one will probably be on target and in focus and reasonably steady. It'll give you the best chance that you've got. But that's it. Other than that, get some lights.
Or get a D800 and you don't have to stop down so far.
Yeah, go to ISO 25,000, whatever it is. This podcast and all the others wouldn't be possible without UK2. We do support them and they support us, and you guys support them like you wouldn't believe. You're buying tons of stuff from them. They've just extended our support for another 2 years. So thank you very much to everyone who's purchased anything from UK2. Go give them a go. Anything for the web that you need, whether it's VPS, VPN, dedicated servers, co-location stuff, anything like that, domains, give them a try. Go to our website, britishtechnetwork.com, and use the click through their logo in the bottom left corner. And when you get it through, it'll open in a new tab. Come back to ours and go to the sponsors link, and all of the offer codes are in there, and you get some fantastic deals, up to 20% off domain names. DNS charge management charges are wiped off completely. You don't pay any of that, and every other customer that's at UK2 does. So British Tech Listeners, don't do that. So you can get great things. Some of their online deals, some are offline deals. Please support UK2 and give them your business. If you want anything to the web, they're well worth it, and the customer services is generally really good from what I've heard from people. And for us, they're brilliant. We've got our own little dedicated man who helps us surf, and thank you, mate. Support them. Thanks very much. Where can we get a hold of you then, Mr. Forsman?
As you mentioned earlier, you can get me at rstechnica.com, or you can hit me on the Twitters at Forsmack.
Good answer. And Alex, where can we get you?
You can get me Alex G. Fox on Twitter. I nearly gave out my email address yet again. Or you can hit me with your river stick.
Well, the email address, you might get some work from, you never know.
No, I don't want any more work, but thanks.
Ooh, that's a proud boast.
Not on August, no.
My name's Ewan Rankin, and you can get me on the Twitters at Ewan Rankin. And there's going to be a new website up soon, because I've expanded my horizons a bit, and I'll tell you more about that next week. Have a good week. Enjoy your photography thing. And
photography.
I'll do that. I'll do that again in the edit, so don't worry about it. See ya.
Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.